This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're going to listen to three interviews with people who have experienced temperatures way lower than the ones you've been complaining about all week. We begin with biologist and author Bill Strever. He's a cold weather enthusiast and as such has traveled the world looking for the most freezing locations he could find. He chronicled all of this in his book Cold, Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. He joined us when the book was first published in 2009. Let's take a listen. So have you always been a lover of the cold, Bill Strever?
I've never hated the cold, but I guess, you know, I grew up in the southeastern U.S., so moving up to Maine when I was about 18, I think, introduced me to the cold, and then moving here to Alaska about 9 years ago really drove home my love of the cold and the cold world that we have up here.
And what do you love so much about it?
Oh, I think the main thing I love about it is walking outside, and you know, I say this all the time, but walking outside on a clear winter day and just getting that first breath of good, strong, cold air just makes you feel glad to be alive. And I think lots of people feel that way.
Oh, indeed. And we don't get the cold weather down here that you get, but I know that feeling of that sort of brisk air on the face. But having read your book, I get the feeling that you think cold's gotten a bad rap over the years. How come?
Oh, you know, everybody knows somebody and probably knows lots of people that are constantly complaining about the cold and putting on a sweater. And I hear people complaining about the winter coming, and I say, hey, yeah, it's time to get the skis waxed up, and make sure we know where the snowshoes are, and good times ahead.
You also say in this book that 20% of the Earth's land is within the permafrost and that 80% of fresh water on Earth is frozen.
Yeah, those are figures that are out there. People have spent time, I suppose, working that out. I just reference those things. But, and the 20% of the Earth's surface, the land surface, is in the permafrost zone. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it's all permafrost. And I think, you know, a lot of people don't really understand what permafrost is, so maybe we should just take a...
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, so permafrost is ground that stays at a temperature below freezing, so below 0 degrees Celsius or below 32 Fahrenheit. It stays below freezing for 2 years or longer, and it's then considered permafrost or permanently frozen. So in the sort of formal definition that's floating around out there, permanent, it turns out, is 2 years. But in most places where there's permafrost, it has been permafrost for many, many thousands of years, right back deep into the Pleistocene. It stayed permanently frozen and remains frozen today. And normally on permafrost, what happens is the first few inches, depending on how far north you are, up to the first 5 or 6 or even 10 feet, thaws out every summer. So that the surface of the ground thaws out, but below that it's frozen, and it's frozen all the way down to a depth at which the Earth's temperature, the warmth coming from the core of the Earth, thaws it out. So in the far northern Alaska, it might be 1,800 feet deep, and it's still frozen ground. And sometimes permafrost has frozen water in the ground, so where there would be groundwater, that water is frozen. Other times it's just soil, and it's fairly dry soil, so it's just very cold soil and very cold rock.
Are you seeing
where there is water, it would be frozen.
It would be frozen. But are you seeing changes in the permafrost because of global warming, for instance?
Oh, yeah, we think we are. It's a hard thing to measure because there's so much variability from I'm going to start to sound too much like a scientist, but there's a lot of change from 1 year to another. So it's difficult to say, well, we're definitely seeing a trend of permafrost degradation. Again, sounding like a scientist, but we're starting to see changes in the surface of the ground. So the upper part of the permafrost is starting to melt. And that's exactly what we'd expect. But where the permafrost is 1,800 feet deep, 1,800 feet thick, nobody that I know would seriously suggest that permafrost is going to disappear in any foreseeable future. So there will still be permafrost, but the active layer, that part of the permafrost that melts and refreezes every year, that active layer will grow thicker. And that has all kinds of consequences, because as the active layer grows thicker, the water that was frozen in that active layer turns into liquid water, and the ground collapses and changes.
And certainly something to keep an eye on up there in Alaska and the Arctic region. I'm curious, and you write about this, about what it takes for people who live in those climates to stay warm. And you talk about the Inuit having a certain kind of blood circulation to their hands and their skin that actually protects them from frostbite. How does that work?
Well, I think it's just better vascularization. So they just have more veins and arteries that are going, supplying warm blood out to their fingers, and a better way of controlling that blood flow. So for most of us that aren't cold adapted, the blood flow to our extremities would get shut off pretty quickly to conserve heat to the core.
Right.
But the downside of that, of course, is that you lose your fingers and toes and nose and earlobes and things like that to frostbite. And there's other examples of people around the world that either have or in the past have had special adaptations to cold temperatures. There were some tribal people in southern South America and Tierra del Fuego that were very cold adapted, and they had a physiological adaptation that allowed that. It's called non-shivering thermogenesis. And what that means is that even though they're not shivering, their body is generating more heat than your body or my body might be able to generate. And when Charles Darwin came across these people in his travels on the Beagle, and he looked at this woman who was holding a baby, and the woman and the baby were virtually naked, and it was sleeting, as it often does down there, and the sleet was dripping down this woman's back and down her baby's back, and she appeared to be entirely comfortable. And, of course, he didn't have a good appreciation of just how comfortable she was because of this non-shivering thermogenesis that she had going on. And he thought that she would be miserable, but in fact, she probably was quite comfortable standing there chatting away to him.
That's fascinating. And shivering is the way that we do try to keep ourselves warm, right?
Yeah, shivering is one thing that people do, sure, and animals, mammals as well, and birds, you know, warm-blooded animals shiver. And that's one thing we do to keep warm, and that's just like doing jumping jacks, right? Mm-hmm. So you're just or running in place. You're just generating some warmth by your muscles contracting.
And you need more calories to stay warm in really cold climates?
Well, sure, yeah. And in fact, even it doesn't have to be that cold. But if your body is generating more heat than it normally would by shivering or by moving or whatever, it will burn more calories. So you can eat another candy bar, right?
Is that right?
Well, yeah, so that's why Alaska is so great, and that's the real reason I love cold.
Exactly. Well, you say, like malaria, and this is about cold, if it doesn't kill you, it will help you lose weight.
Yeah, they have a bit of a joke, but yeah, people in the Arctic, especially in the farther northern parts of Alaska, and in the winter, we do tend to eat more and take on more calories, and we also do tend to put on more weight. So I don't think we have the balance quite right. But you know, there's a drive that tells you when it's cold, you need to take on more calories, and you're hungrier, and you will burn more calories just.
Sure.
To stay warm.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the animals that seem to be so well adapted to the cold. You write about something called boreal frogs, which you describe it as frozen popsicles.
Yeah, wood frogs. There's a frog. Well, there's four species of frogs, I think, that are known to overwinter in a frozen state, and they literally do freeze. The fluid that's between their cells freezes. The fluid inside their cells probably doesn't freeze. So they kind of flush the fluid inside their cells out of the cells, and the cells themselves are reasonably dry, so there's not a lot in there to freeze. And what is there is very, very full of dissolved material, so it has a lower freezing temperature. But the liquid that's between the cells freezes, and then you can pick one of these frogs up in this frozen state, and it would appear to be, you know, in common experience, it would appear to be dead because, after all, it's frozen. And yet, when spring rolls around and the frog thaws out, it will hop away.
You describe lemmings having snowbound orgies.
Yeah, so that's another strategy for overwintering. Most small mammals can't hibernate, and a lot of people don't realize that, but the very small mammals have to stay active in the winter. They can't hibernate because they would freeze and die. Their surface area of their body is so large relative to the volume of their body that they can't hold enough heat to hibernate. So they have to stay active, and one way of doing that is to live under the snow in tunnels. And those are animals that do that are called subnivians, sort of a word that's out there that people use, subnivian animals. And these lemmings are subnivians, and they have this very active life under the snow, and in fact can reproduce under the snow, and a newborn can then mature under the snow and have babies of its own before it ever sees the daylight of spring.
Speaking about hibernating, we know about hibernating bears, and you do describe, I don't know if it's a fellow biologist, but someone crawling into a cave where a bear was hibernating, I guess, to listen to the numbers of or the amount of heart rate there?
Yeah, I think you're probably thinking of Lynn Rogers, and Lynn is a biologist. I think he's, if I remember right, he's based in Minnesota now. And Lynn built his whole career around understanding various aspects of bears, including bear hibernation, and was one of many bear biologists who crawls into dens and samples bears in various ways, including listening to their heartbeat and their breathing rate and things like that. And he has one really nice story that he tells where the bear woke up. And oftentimes you'll hear people say, well, bears don't really hibernate. They're not true hibernators. And what they mean by that is that bears aren't in a deep, deep stupor like some other animals, like ground squirrels are. And bears can, in fact, wake up fairly quickly from hibernation. I would argue that it is hibernation.
Do you think there's something about diet and being able to withstand the cold, Bill?
Oh, absolutely. There's something about diet and being able to withstand the cold, and even special foods that native people eat. And the one I hear most frequently is for staying warm on a cold day is walrus meat. Walrus blubber is supposed to be especially good, and of course whale blubber, which is pure fat. And I think just by the jaw action of chewing the stuff is probably generating some heat as well. But then once it's in your stomach and you're digesting it, it's generating heat. It's full of energy, and that energy is getting turned into glycogen in your body, and your cells are burning it, and they're generating heat. So sure, there's something to it. I've also seen, I've not done this, I don't think I could quite bring myself to do this, but I have seen people eat sticks of butter, just like a candy bar, eat a stick of butter to stay warm.
What happens when it's 40, 50 degrees below zero, and do cars actually run in that cold weather?
Oh, yeah, they run. They can be very hard to start, and that's, people plug their cars in, not because they have electric cars, which seem to be a coming trend, but because there's a heat blanket around the battery, so the battery stays warm, and the heat blanket sometimes also around the oil pan so that the oil stays warm. And when it's very, very cold like that, the oil takes on a consistency almost like tar, and then getting the car started, you've got to churn through that very, very thick oil, and it's much harder to start. But sure, you can start your car. All the steel parts become more brittle, and that's a problem. The tires can become very stiff, and when you park your car, you can see there's a little flat bit in the bottom of the tire where the tire is against the ground, and in normal temperatures that's not a problem. But when it's very, very cold and the tire is very stiff because it's so cold, that flat bit stays with you for a while. So you're sort of driving along, thump, thump, thump down the road like you have four flat tires until the friction against the road warms the tires up and they come back into round.
It's freezing.
That was my interview with author and biologist Bill Strever about his book Cold, Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. Despite his affinity for chillier temperatures, he's gone on to write Heat, about the world's hottest places, and he's planning another book about wind. This is Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about a 19th century polar adventure. Stay with us.
What are you doing out in it? Come inside, love. You're as cold as ice. You're willing to sacrifice our love.
Welcome back to the coldest Radio Times in Review yet. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We'll continue our travels to the coldest places in the world by listening to my conversation with historian and author Hampton Sides. He joined us back in 2014 to discuss the 19th century polar adventure of the USS Jeannette. The expedition was sponsored by an eccentric newspaperman who wasn't just interested in reporting the news, he wanted to create it. The mission was a failure, and the crew was forced to abandon their ship and fight for survival in the Arctic ice. Sides chronicled the journey in his book, In the Kingdom of Ice. Let's listen. Tell us about this Arctic fever that seemed to be felt by so many people in this country.
Yeah. Well, I kind of had to scrape away, everything that I knew to be true about the Arctic and about the North Pole in order to try to understand what people back then thought was up there, because it was this nagging, gnawing obsession. It was like, as someone said in one of the accounts that I quote, it's like a man has to know what his own attic looks like. And it drives people insane. And it was one of the few places left that man had not touched and had not been able to reach. And so there were all these theories about what was up there. And some of the theories went back to the Vikings and the Greeks. This notion of an open polar sea goes way back. There's a map from the 1500s, a Mercator map, that shows this open polar sea with these perfectly symmetrical river channels that lead into it. And I think once you get something on a map, it becomes really difficult to dislodge it from the public imagination. And so what happens is these great scientists, all the eminent scientists, instead of coming up with their own theories or just saying, I don't know, had to enlarge upon that idea. And so the Jeannette expedition was one of the first, and it was also the last expedition to expressly test the open polar sea theory. And, you know, unfortunately, as often happens in Arctic exploration, people have to lose their lives and go through hell to test some of these theories.
This was also a time of exploration. And as you say, this was a part of the world that, for all the reasons that would make sense, was unmapped. So I guess the fact that it was unmapped and people had not gone there just enlarged its fascination.
Yeah. Up to that point, most of the exploration in the Arctic had been designed to find the Northwest Passage or to find ships that had gotten lost looking for the Northwest Passage. This was one of the first ones where they were saying, there may or may not be a Northwest Passage, but we're going to go straight to this bigger grail, this more abstract goal of finding the North Pole. There was a lot of nationalism involved too, because the U.S. wanted to beat other nations and reach it first. We had come out of the devastation of the Civil War, and we were aiming to do big things during the Gilded Age. There was some money now, and there was some a growing sense of we need to kind of flex our muscles on the world stage. And this was a way to do that in lieu of war. This was this kind of quasi-military attempt to do something that was glorious for the nation.
And, of course, there were wealthy benefactors who were interested in this, including this this man named James Gordon Bennett. He was the owner of the New York Herald. As you write, a man that not only wrote about the news but made up news to sell newspapers. Mm-hmm. But he was interested in this, in these, I guess, kinds of adventures.
Yes. James Gordon Bennett was this half-mad playboy publisher of the New York Herald. He was one of the richest men in America. He inherited the Herald from his dad, and he was really interested in these serialized adventure stories. Don't just print the news and cover the news, but in fact generate spectacles that will just keep producing more and more stories. The most famous of these was the story of Stanley. He sent Stanley to find Livingston in Africa and got a huge sensation from that, both in terms of circulation for the paper, but also it produced some knowledge. It actually, you know, even though it was a newspaper stunt, it expanded our knowledge of Africa and it led to more exploration in Africa. So he realized this was another one of those kinds of stories, and he bankrolled this entire expedition.
Wow, how much?
I never actually did the final tally, and what it would be in today's dollars would be, you know, tens of millions of dollars probably. But this is the USS Jeannette. It's a Navy expedition. It was run by Navy officers under naval rules. But the Navy of that time was quite weak, quite anemic, and it had to be this unique hybrid kind of thing, which would be now considered very unorthodox. The Navy would not go in with a newspaper publisher or, say, you know, Ted Turner, or who would be the equivalent today. But then there was really no other way to do this. And I think it said something about the kind of way we organize things in this country, that you could – some guy could come in with the money. The Navy provides the reinforcement for the ship and the expertise. and they head out from San Francisco toward the Bering Strait.
Well, and the captain is a man named George Washington DeLong, and he was a pretty well-known captain at the time. And as you describe him, I mean, he seems like he was a good captain. I mean, a captain that, as he said, I command, they obey, talking about his crew, but nonetheless believed in that.
Yeah, he was very old school. He was very, very much of a disciplinarian. He was quite aware of the fact that just about all the Arctic explorations up to then had problems with mutiny and scurvy and sometimes cannibalism and all the classics. He was real clear on his leadership and how it had to be organized. He had this motto, nil desperandum, you know, never despair, never despair, never despair. And he held this group together over this ordeal.
Well, as you say, there were 32 members of the crew. But you say an interesting thing that for some of them, they were looking for adventure and perhaps glory, and that they had parents who fought in the Civil War, and they themselves wanted to be able to, I guess, be a man and go out and go to this sort of unknown part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, that was certainly part of the appeal. You might ask now, why would anyone want to go up there in a situation that was virtually guaranteed to produce death and hardship and starvation and so forth? But part of it was that this was the generation that had just missed the Civil War, and their uncles and fathers and grandfathers and brothers had fought in this great conflict. And they had missed it. And so there was an element of history had passed me by. Let's do something equally big and ambitious. And that certainly was true for Captain DeLong. He had missed the Civil War by literally months. And there was almost like a chip on their shoulder, like we got to do something even bigger. And Arctic exploration was one venue that was sort of accepted as a path to glory and a path to expanding national might and science as well, because it really was a genuine puzzle. People did not know what was up there, and you know, it might be one of the great discoveries of all time. If perhaps there was a civilization or actually was an open polar sea, this sort of thing.
And they left believing that there could be or probably was an open polar sea.
Yes, they did. I mean, I think here's the thing. They knew they would encounter ice because all the Arctic whalers had encountered ice. But the Arctic whalers had never intentionally rammed themselves in the ice, pointing north, hoping to get to this polar sea. They thought the theory was that there was this girdle of ice. Sometimes it was called an annulus of ice, a ring of ice, that if you could just get through it, preferably finding a gateway where it was a little weak from one of these warm water currents like the Gulf Stream, you would finally break through and get to this sea. And that was the leading theory of the time.
Now, the USS Jeannette is, 30 feet long, something like that. So not a huge ship.
Not a huge boat at all, no.
But what was interesting is that Edison helped to put lights in the ship. Alexander Graham Bell got involved as well. This was a pretty well-equipped ship.
Yeah, they wanted to have communications on the ship. They wanted to have lighting to light up the polar night. It's dark for 6 months of the year. They wanted to have all the latest inventions. And this was a very well-equipped they also want to conduct a lot of scientific experiments while they were up there in terms of the quality of the ice and the depth of the water and salinity and barometric pressure. So they had all the instruments that they needed to conduct essentially to create a weather station up there because they knew they would be in ice. They just thought it would be a few months. They didn't realize that it would be 2 years. And they were well-fed for the 2 years. They had plenty of food. They had entertainment. They had an organ on the ship. They had entertainments of all sorts and plays and musicals. They were kind of going slowly mad from boredom and inaction, but they were doing okay until the incredible pressure of the ice finally crushed the hull of the ship.
Yeah, which had been obviously reinforced. It's kind of amazing to imagine, you know, going out, first of all, not exactly knowing where you're going in today's, GPS-centric
right.
world where we know exactly where we are all the time, but thinking as well that you'd be gone for, 2 or 3 years if you were going to take off on one of these voyages. Your book also includes some really touching letters that DeLong's wife writes, hoping, I don't know if he ever got them.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine.
She called them her letters to nowhere because she was sending them up to the Arctic via Arctic whaling vessels and other ships. And Emma DeLong, she's becomes a major character in the book and was a great writer. Historians always wish for this sort of scenario to happen that happened to me. It's never happened before for me, but it's the phone call from a little old lady who basically says, I've got a trunk full of old letters.
How did she know you were doing this?
I actually called her looking for her late husband. I was calling everybody named DeLong in Connecticut because I'd heard that there were relatives there. And Catherine DeLong said, you know, that's so funny that you call because I've got this trunk full of letters and they are the personal papers of Emma DeLong, Commander DeLong's wife. And I really didn't know what to do with them. Would you like to come get them? On loan, of course. And I said, would I ever? I flew as quickly as I could to Connecticut. And these were her personal papers, including all of these letters that she wrote. She saved copies of all of these letters. And they're beautiful. And ultimately, as the story becomes more and more tragic, they're heart-wrenching letters. And she had sailed aboard the Jeannette around the Horn to San Francisco with her husband. She knew every inch of that vessel. She knew every detail about the expedition. So she wasn't just a romantic writer writing, in the abstract. She was writing about details of the expedition and the science that it was based on. And she becomes a major character in the book. It's really largely it's a love story between the two of them.
Well, at one point, even before they leave, he says to her, you know, you'll make a beautiful widow. I don't know if he was preparing her. But, I mean, these were dangerous trips.
Everyone knew that, there was a strong likelihood that you're going to die or suffer unimaginable horrors or starvation, scurvy, and whatever. I don't think Emma had any doubts about how dangerous this was. She understood that. But nonetheless, his intention was to go to the North Pole and come out on the other side and make it home. And they had a child, Sylvie DeLong, and he certainly didn't have a death wish, and he wanted to get back.
He seemed to be just almost obsessed with the North Pole, the Arctic, with even ice itself.
Yeah. There's something that happens to people who go to the Arctic. Either you love it or you hate it. And he was one of the ones who absolutely fell in love with it when he went to Greenland several years before. The sounds, the atmospheric phenomena, what light does, obviously the northern lights, and then this terrific puzzle that we've been talking about that just pulls you in, and it's obsessive. So even though the food may be bad and the weather is horrible, and the conditions are very, very claustrophobic, and the snow and ice is monotonous, there's just something. Just about everyone in that ship had been to the Arctic before, usually aboard whaling vessels, and they kept wanting to go back. They couldn't get enough of it.
You describe, I guess, after, 2 years of being stuck in ice and really just floating, right? Mm-hmm. Floating in these ice flows?
Yeah, I mean, the ice is constantly moving, and they're generally heading in the right direction. They're heading towards the North Pole. But it's a very circuitous route, and some days they're going backwards and some days they're going forward. Enormous pressures on the hull of the ship, but the ship had been massively reinforced and did quite well for most of that time. But finally, the pressure became too great, and it made terrific noises and screeching sounds, and the pine tar was coming out of the seams of the ship. It was like being throttled to death, and finally it sank to the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. Wow. And these 33 men and their 40 dogs and three small open boats and some very bare supplies, they're out there 1,000 miles from the nearest landmass, which is the central coast of Siberia. And so they start dragging their stuff south. And it really becomes one of the great survival stories of all time. It's a Shackleton kind of story, 35 years before the Endurance, an American Shackleton. And that's in some ways where the story really begins.
Well, and I'm trying to imagine again, you know, trying to drag these boats across, I guess it's ice, but nonetheless, mm-hmm. just the what it would take, the kind of physical stamina you'd have yeah. to have to do something like that.
It's just so hard. And, you know, everyone's in harness. They're essentially like mules, you know, mm-hmm. dragging this stuff. And, the ice pack is not like this nice, smooth surface that you can skate over or something like that. It's just jagged and full of meltwater and pools and puddles, and they keep falling in, mm-hmm. and unbelievably hard work. And they didn't have enough food, so they were constantly hunting as they went. They discover another island along the way, which is called Bennett Island. That sort of saves them. They finally, you know, have a place where they can have plenty to eat. They eat a lot of birds and other wildlife and kind of lick their wounds for a while and then keep heading on until they finally do reach open water and set sail for the Siberian coast.
Well, and one can only imagine just how cold it was. You talk, mm-hmm. you know, you write about these blinding snowstorms and mm-hmm. there are pictures of obviously them with their coats and all, but mm-hmm. but nonetheless, you know, how do you stay warm under those circumstances? Yeah. Perhaps you can't.
Yeah. Well, luckily, the ship sank in June, and this was summertime. So there was endless amount of sunlight, and it was surprisingly warm during the middle of the day for much of this. But that brings its own problems because there's meltwater everywhere. They're constantly wet. They're constantly falling in. You're never really sure what time of year is the best time of year, because they could actually move faster when it's really cold and hard out there. But they do reach open water, and they set sail in these three boats, and these three boats have three very different fates.
That was my 2014 conversation with author, historian, and journalist Hampton Sides about his book, In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Voyage of the USS Jeannette. I'm Artie Moskowain, and if you think you're cold now, keep listening to this polar edition of Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from the first man to cross the Antarctic by himself, on foot no less. Stay with us.
Ice, ice, baby. Ice, ice, baby. Ice, ice, baby.
And now it's cold outside. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thanks for joining us. We conclude our ice-cold edition of Radio Times in Review by replaying a portion of my discussion with the co-founder of La Colombe Coffee, Todd Carmichael. But if you think we were going to warm you up with a hot cup of joe, you are sorely mistaken. Outside of founding one of the area's premier boutique coffee companies, he's also an adventurer and was the first person to make a solo expedition across the Antarctic on foot. He joined us in 2009 to discuss his journey and how it feels to be that cold. Let's listen. You know, I'm looking at your face, and when you walked in the door, I was looking very carefully at your face because some of the photos on your website shows this face that looks so painful. You have frostbite. You have bits and pieces of your face that are just bright red. How much time did it take to recover from your trip?
Well, I would say it's been about 2.5 months now. And I think I'm just at that point where I can say I'm recovered. The skin on the face takes a couple weeks, but it's a lot of the weight and even, you know, the texture and the quality of your muscles. You know, when you come back, to give you an idea, when I arrived at the pole, there's a station there, and they invited me in, and I had to climb up a set of stairs, and I couldn't manage it.
Really?
I really couldn't. I was holding onto the railing, and I literally didn't have any strength in my muscles left.
You had just worn yourself out on this trek?
Exactly. And when your body burns its own muscle, it's not really selective. It kind of takes evenly. So the muscle that's left, and it's very small, is very weak. I mean, you really have grandma arms.
You have grandma arms.
Grandma arms at the end, yeah.
Jeez. You also hurt your lungs in part. That's, I mean, right. I'm assuming just breathing that cold air. We're talking about beyond 0 degree temperatures,
right.
obviously,
yeah.
and winds up to 100 miles an hour.
That's right.
And you're
yeah.
breathing that stuff, right?
And you're heaving the whole time. It's not just a shallow breath. Right. And for me, it was more acute because it was about 50 below zero. But typically you travel – when you try to do this trek, you work about 9 to 10 hours a day. But the first day I broke my skis.
Right.
And so I did it in ski boots, which meant that I had to work 15 to 16 hours a day, just really heaving. And I burned the inside of my lungs.
Wow. Have they recovered? Have they repaired themselves?
You can still hear a little bit of
a little kind of a frogginess.
Yeah, there's a frogginess and a kind of a wheeze that goes on. And that's just what's left is the frostbite in the main bronchial tube.
Is that repairable or is it just going to take more time?
It's repairable, yeah.
Well, Todd Carmichael, why the heck did you want to do this?
Well, you know, trekking before to me, you know, which was, you know, 200 milers and, you know, across jungles and things in 2 weeks. Was just kind of my way of expressing my freedom, you know. It's just something that I enjoyed. But this particular one, in 2004, it just got planted in my mind and took over, you know. I'd like to say that I suppose, you know, I've said this before and it sounds really way too poetic to be true, but if tomorrow I woke and I sprout a new pair, let's say a pair of wings, I just think that naturally I wouldn't just fly around in my yard, you know. I would say, wow, how far can I go? How high can I go? And I guess that's what I'm doing with my legs.
Were you daredevil kid? I mean, one of those kids that just was sort of roaming and had ants in their pants, so
I
to
had
speak?
Definite, yeah, fire ants. I just all over constantly. I have three sisters, and I was kind of the family mascot for that reason. But I've never really been an adrenaline junkie. I really don't care for adrenaline all that much. It makes me nervous. Mm-hmm. And these types of things aren't really adrenaline-driven. I mean, people think, wow, do you base jump? And I think, well, you know what? No, trekking is quite the opposite. It's that slow grinding and just trying to reach out and touch the horizon. That's the idea.
You were a runner, though, right?
A distance runner.
A distance runner.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, part of – were you on a track team?
Yeah. I was an All-American in high school and college. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Distance was just in my nature.
And did you continue that running after college?
I didn't. You know, I had different focuses, and you know, one of them was coffee, and I applied the same kind of techniques to my business as I did running, meaning just, you know, be the last guy standing.
Right.
And it wasn't until my mid-30s that I just really felt there was something missing in my life. You know, I really missed that, you know, that focus that you have. And you know, as a trekker, since you're always, you know, preparing mentally for the, you know, a big challenge, you're never bored in your daily life. You know, if you get 15 minutes in a dentist office, it gives you an opportunity to sit back and think about what you're going to do. You know,
planning imagining,
and visualizing, and yeah, particularly this last one.
How did you though prepare? I mean, is it really possible to prepare for a 700-mile trek in or on the Antarctic in Pennsylvania?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I did it. You know, you need three aspects to your body. You need to have ultra endurance ability, and that just requires doing ultra endurance. You know, for me, you know, the weekends I would do 8-hour bike rides or 8-hour runs. I also, for the last couple months, I rigged up two big tractor tires and weighted them down, connected them to chains, and then had a pair of roller skis made for me, and I just went up and down the hills of Gladwin and drove everyone crazy. I mean, literally 8-hour stints pulling these sled, you know, these tires.
Well, your neighbors must have
gotten
a couple of chuckles watching you prepare.
Yeah, one I remember, someone drove up on Conshohocken State Road. It was a nice old man. He asked me if I needed any help, like I was delivering these things somewhere. I said, no, I got them. I'm good.
But literally just drag, because you did drag a sled when you were in Antarctica.
Yeah, 250-pound sled.
So you were dragging these big tires just to...
To mimic that, right. And then, you know, you need strength. And I did a huge amount of strength training with a man named Roger Schwab. And it was very intense strength training. What we did was we drove my heart rate up to about 160 clicks. And then I would go from machine to machine, 17, 18 machines in 30 minutes. Just so we were working on endurance and strength. Mm-hmm. And then finally, needed to be fat. So I just ate and ate and ate and ate. I took on as much weight as I could.
How much weight did you take on?
Well, you know, with all the endurance, it was hard. You know, my natural, you know, I'd say my natural weight for my age is about 195 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I got it up to 220, which for me is just bloated. You know, it's just huge. And then, you know, by the time I came back, I was in the 160s.
Now, when you were there, and I found this fascinating, I mean, obviously you needed a lot of calories. You got mm-hmm. a lot of those calories from butter.
Butter.
Just like sticks of butter?
Well, you know, it starts out as something that you add to your food.
Right.
And, you know, you bring pounds and pounds of it. So you're just dropping a stick in everything but your tea. But near the end, I was just so desperate. I just had so little time that I was just devouring sticks of it when I could. you know, and I had extra. So, and it's just a huge amount of calories per weight.
When you're living in those conditions, though, how much, I mean, how many calories do you think you actually needed to keep yourself from losing all that weight? I mean, how many calories do you think to?
12,000. That's the calculation. Yeah.
And that's because it's cold and your body has to work hard to stay warm.
Yeah. Your metabolism kicks up. And then just the, you know, the effort of, you know, here's the thing about Antarctica. You know, we envision it and we look at, you know, we see it on a map. You think it's this nice flat place. But going from Hercules Inlet to the pole, it's 15,000 feet straight up.
Wow.
I mean, it's like a massive volcano, really, with the South Pole right in the center. So you're dragging the sled straight uphill and on very uneven territory.
So you describe this as the coldest, the driest, the highest, and the windiest place.
That's
in the
right.
World.
Yeah, it's four. Yeah, it's four things.
Four out of
four.
Yeah,
that's not even my opinion. Yeah, that's just the way it is. Yeah, and the windiest. It's due to what's called catabolic winds, and the winds always come from the south, from a higher point, lower, and you know, particularly down in Hercules Inlet, they just rip. I mean, rip. It's you know, on average, a given day it's 40 knots, so it's 50 miles an hour on average, and it can really get moving. I mean, I brought a Kendrel, I think it's what it's called. It judges the wind speed. And at one storm, I'm, you know, literally sticking out of the tent on a stick, and it just jammed. That was it. It couldn't take any more wind.
Wow.
So I didn't have any measure of it. But, it, you know, it base camp a couple times got to 100 miles an hour.
And is that the noise you hear when you're alone in the Antarctic, the sound of the wind?
Yeah. It's not a quiet place. You know, there are times, though, when it gets just perfectly quiet, and I swear it's just – it's poetic. It's beautiful. And it's just you. And it's quiet like that.
Yeah. You also did, I don't know if hallucinate is too strong a word, but you had some hallucinations. I don't think that would be that unusual in that environment. I know at times you were living on just a couple of hours of sleep at night, which, you know, can play tricks with your mind.
It really can, yeah.
Did you actually have real hallucinations?
I had two sorts. You know, I agree. You know, to hallucinate in daily life while you're a coffee roaster, not a very good thing. Right. Yeah, try to avoid that. Or that would be frightening. But there... I recognized it was beginning, and it was something that I welcomed. The first thing is, when things really got dangerous the last 3 or 4 days, in my left peripheral, you know, field of vision, my grandfather's house appeared in a very clear way. If I looked at it, it would just keep moving and stay in my peripheral vision. I know what my mind was doing was saying, well, you know, the safest place that you can ever think of is your grandfather's front yard. And it stayed there for days and days on end.
Wow. That was comforting then, I guess.
It was very comforting. It's the reason why, actually, that I froze my left eye finally because, yeah.
And you told me this before we went on the air, so you must describe how you froze your left eye, what you looked like.
Well, yeah, what happened is that after a while, that the vision of my grandfather's house became very annoying. You know, it's just, I couldn't take it anymore. And I needed relief from it, so I closed my left eye for too long. And spindrift and snow developed and packed over the eye and froze it. When I, you know, I finally arrived at the pole and removed my mask and everything like that, it was a pretty spooky sight.
Because you had one eye looking at
the left.
Grandfather's house, so to speak.
My left eye kind of wandered to the left, and when I opened my eyes, it looked like, you know, that I had a glass eye. It was pretty spooky.
Wow. Were you ever not cold?
You're always cold, but you always want to be cold, believe it or not. The biggest fear is getting overheated, which is very easy to do when you're pulling that kind of weight uphill. Because once you begin to perspire, then that could be the end of everything for you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, water is your enemy. It keeps you alive, but at the same time, you have to think of it like fire.
So you had to get the right kind of clothing just to keep you warm enough, but not overheat you so that you would be sweating. And then sweating, it gets cold, right? And then you've got also the temperature problem.
Freeze. Yeah, then you start in this wild ride of getting too hot, too cold, too hot, and then you could end up really getting hurt.
Wow.
And the way you do it is through vent. I do it with vents. So I have like a suit that has zippers everywhere. And, you know, as you stop, you zip them all up, keep yourself warm for a couple minutes just to get your, you know, food on or whatever. And then start pulling in and unzip and get a, you know, airflow around inside your suit.
Now, did you have some kind of a covering over your your skin on your face so you could see where you were going, obviously?
Yeah.
But you don't want to expose any of your skin as well.
Yeah, I wear goggles. And then I sew a neoprene veil into the the foam of the goggles, so it comes down over me. And you know, it takes just seconds as you breathe on it. The veil gets, you know, as hard as a rock, and it protects you. And then you tape your face up, and wear a balaclava. So you have to keep it away. You
know? But there are pictures of you with tape on your nose. I mean, clearly your skin really felt – the skin on your face took a real beating.
Yeah.
I mean, you look like you've been in a fight, frankly.
Yeah. And that's unusual too, because if you see some of the videos, what happens to your cheeks is when they get really cold. And then, you know, remember you're sleeping at night and it's about 20 degrees in the tent, so your face never really gets the opportunity to thaw out like other parts of your body. And it begins just to swell, like you look like a chipmunk for a long time. I mean, and it's really like you've got hockey pucks in your mouth.
Yeah.
And it's very painful. Yeah, very painful.
Your fingers also swelled and
your fingers swell up, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is circulation, I guess, circulatory.
That's from the pounding. Yeah. Because you have poles that in every step you're hitting the ice with the poles, and it's just that pounding and pounding on your fists. And millions of steps. And, you know, I broke bones in the feet from stress fractures and things like that.
Oh. Are you a masochist?
Yeah. I don't get any pleasure. I get pleasure from being there. You know, if the cost were a little lower, it'd be nicer. But.
Right. But just being – I mean, were there days where you just felt like I'm the luckiest man on this planet?
Yeah. Yeah, there
I'm
were.
Down here alone on the Antarctic, and I got the place to myself. So
yeah. I said, this is a really good day. You know, this is a really good day.
Had you ever been alone? Now, you had some contact. I mean, you could call your wife. You could stay in touch with other people. But you were by yourself trekking for, you know, 39 days, 7 hours, 49
minutes.
But had you ever been alone for that period of time, really alone in this very remote part of the world?
No. Well, you know, there was – the year before, I thought it was only reasonable that I would do it with a team first and then try solo. But, you know, my team member just – he broke pretty hard in the first couple of days.
He couldn't do it, you mean?
Yeah. Both primarily mentally, but physically. You know, once you mentally you give up, your body just, you know, jacks it in too.
Right.
And so I wasn't unwilling to – I didn't want the expedition to stop. So I went forward another 20 days without him. So I got an experience of being alone out there for that time. But before that, no. But, you know, I just don't think that's – part of the challenge. A lot of people look at me as solo. That's so tough.
Yeah.
I think it's harder with people. The only thing I really like to do with other people is surf. You know, if the best way to, you know, cut your, you know, the possibility of you being eaten by a shark in half is to go surfing with someone else, you know?
I didn't know.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Because they could get, no, I'm just teasing. You know, I agree. The amount of danger that you're going to experience because you're alone is much higher. You know, I ended up inside three crevasses this last expedition, and it would have been really nice to have been tied to someone else during those times. So, you know, you do recognize it, you take it on. So before you go out solo, you know, you have to recognize, listen, you're taking on more risk. But I do understand that at the same time, if someone makes a mistake, you know, it's, you know, your problems are multiplied by two now. You know, things like, you know, burning down the tent. Because that's it. You're done. I mean, the chances of you surviving that are pretty slim. And I happen to be a person who just takes that very seriously, the stove, and a lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's tough. And when you look at another person in pain, it reminds you of your own. And it's really grueling. And, you know, you see that reflection. And often negative things can be brought up by the other person. And I try not to bring up anything negative in my mind at all. And then finally, I tend to push really hard. And it's hard to find someone who wants to push that hard.
As hard as you did.
Yeah.
I'm curious, I mean, if you had those thoughts, maybe those thoughts saying, what the heck am I doing here?
What am I doing out here?
Why, you know, maybe I'd like to go home. Mm-hmm. You just would push those thoughts out of your mind and just say, I'm just not going to think. Those were illegal.
Yeah, anything even negative, like you think of, oh, wow, I can't believe I did that when I was 14. Or, you know, some stray negative idea must be eliminated. And then there's no negotiations. You never negotiate with yourself. Ever. Never allow that. You know those, well, maybe I'll sleep in an extra 15 minutes and then I'll add. Once that begins, then it just unravels from there. And other people tend to want to do that.
Huh.
And for me, it's the Constitution. It can't be broken. And now it's cold
outside. That was my 2009 conversation with La Colombe Coffee co-founder and adventurer Todd Carmichael about his experience being the first person to travel alone across the Antarctic to the South Pole. And that wraps up the ice-cold edition of Radio Times in Review. 20 degrees doesn't sound so bad now, does it? Radio Times in Review is produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Stay warm.